Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, we'll hear from Kali Okuno, an organizer with Cooperation Jackson, on why many Black Americans are suspicious of liberal gun control schemes. And at the bottom of the hour, the economist Sabri Anshu will explain Turkey's economic and political troubles. Before we get to all that, a thank you to those who contributed to KPFA during our recent fundraiser. We can't do it without you. And if you forgot to contribute, it's never too late. Just visit our website at kpfa.org and pledge securely. First, guns. After every school shooting, we hear the same voices saying the same things over and over. Liberals pleading for gun control and conservatives saying no way. And while the right-wing position sometimes looks irrational to some on the left, as Mark Ames argued several years ago, it's an essential part of their anti-collectivist, individualist, competitive worldview. If you see life as the war of each against all, it makes sense to be well-armed. But do those two positions exhaust all possibilities? No, argues my first guest. Kali Okuno is an organizer with Cooperation Jackson, an attempt to create an autonomous collective economy in the capital city of Mississippi, which, despite that status, is deeply poor. It's also 80% Black. Cooperation Jackson's relationship with the city's progressive mayor, Chakwe Antar Lumumba, is, as they say on Facebook, complicated, but the organization's relationship with the state government is one of intense mutual hostility. We've discussed all this during Okuno's earlier appearances in Behind the News, but what I wanted to talk about this time was his view that Black Americans can never embrace gun control in a society where cops and vigilantes have it out for them. Here's Kali Okuno with more. I want to talk about guns, but I'm just wondering how are things going with Cooperation Jackson?
Fairly good. I mean, there's a little rough patch that we've been going through with trying to hold the city and our comrades accountable on some stuff on the level of government. So there's been some challenges there. But in terms of the actual co-ops themselves moving forward, that's going good. That's going great.
And the state legislature still at war with you?
Oh, yes.
That's a given, right?
Yeah. I'd be scared. I wouldn't know what to do if they weren't. I'd be more scared if they weren't plotting and scheming. That means something else is maybe afoot, you know.
So. Yeah, that or you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
All right. Every time there's a school shooting, which seems like it happens every other day now, there's a lot of revised talk or debate over gun control. And on the one hand, I think, you know, this is a society that's just crazy with weapons and just overarmed and violent and all. But something gives me pause about the gun control discourse, liberal gun control discourse. How do you feel about it?
I think it's extremely patronizing on the one hand, and I think it belies a deep trust of a very violent state, and it doesn't question the nature of that state. And so it winds up being, in many respects, I think, and I'm speaking primarily from a Black historical perspective, it winds up being a way to actually inhibit people from protecting themselves, as opposed to allowing people to have the means to protect themselves. So in that regard, I find a lot of the kind of, particularly the present conversation, the contextualization of the conversation around gun control, deeply racist, to put it mildly.
Well, but a lot of the dominant gun culture in the U.S. is fairly right-wing, fairly white, and often heavily tinged with racism. Is that not the full picture?
No, I don't think it is the full picture. I think there's some acknowledgement by way of the social movement that racism exists, that it has an impact, but there's no critical within a lot of the I think there's a beauty, let me put it this way, I think there's a beauty to what happened after the shooting in Florida. That there were, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young students who found their voice, took to the streets, demanded some accountability on behalf of the politicians, went so far as to raise issues around Black children, particularly in Chicago, but all throughout the country, being raised folks, I think, did a some of those students in Florida did an excellent position, excellent job of utilizing their position to raise certain critical issues. But it was done largely in the vacuum. And that's not something that I think you would expect 17, 18, or 19-year-olds to fully know and to grasp the depth of the history of racism in this country and how it has played out in regards to state violence and other forms of sanction, you know, violence against Black people, Latinos, indigenous people in this country. And what I think it left out is the broader dynamic of the nature of this society, what it is founded on, what it is articulated in, and the nature in which violence is being a central tool of how the U.S. has been constructed and how it actually operates on a daily basis, both inside this, you know, the boundaries of what's called the United States government, and definitely externally all throughout the world. And until we have a serious conversation about the very nature of the U.S. government itself, right, and this whole edifice of violence that was created from day one, I think you're having a conversation which only serves to strengthen a very repressive state by removing some ability of people to kind of protect themselves. If you wind up in some very dangerous territory. Now, what do I mean by that? Because some people may be lost. So I think it's worth kind of going into some history. And I want to take people back basically to the period of time which, you know, most of us consider Reconstruction, which was a very short period of time, roughly from if you follow the mainstream narrative of it, from 1865 to 1877. But there's a particular period in there, roughly that begins around 1868, 1869, where there's a concerted effort that was made largely by the old plantation, you know, white ruling class that dominated the South, the antebellum South, to regain control. And the way in which they had to regain control was to disarm the Black population, particularly the Black Union soldiers who were part of the different types of patrols in the South. And that program not only went to just disarming those soldiers, it eventually went to disarming the entire population in the community of Black people who had just been removed from the condition of chattel slavery. And it was the disarming of this community which allowed for another 100 years of a new form of slavery, primarily in the form of sharecropping, convict leasing labor laws, you know, other types of pass laws which restricted where Black people could go, how many Black people could be associated with whom, etc. And that was done through the agency of the state. And if you are absent of that type of history, then you miss the whole conversation about who certain populations have to be protected from and why they have to be protected from, you know, the U.S. government. And that is a piece that I think we have to reinsert into this conversation if we're serious about dealing with gun violence and who's allowed to be protected in this society by the state and the government. And then there's a deeper question as to should that be the role and function of the government, period. But that's a deeper conversation. But just in regards to some of these things about, you know, gun control laws, what I am definitely afraid of with this current kind of liberal dialogue which is going on is that you're going to try to disarm the Black community at the very time that there is a rising neo-Confederate, neo-fascist movement which is already armed to the teeth and has, particularly under this current administration, has been giving a lot of license and a lot of encouragement in very open and obvious ways to perpetuate violence against folks who are deemed not to be human. And this comes directly from the president's mouth, just from the comments he made about folks, you know, trying to migrate to this country in search of a means to survive because of the ravages of imperialisms in their own country. So this comes from the top. And I think this is a piece that has to be contextualized in this conversation. Otherwise, I think it just winds up being a very targeted discussion, which leaves a number of folks vulnerable. And that, from my position, cannot be allowed.
No, I think a lot of liberals, to be fair to them, not that I'm always fair to them, but I think a lot of liberals would want to disarm those neo-Confederates and neo-Nazis. Wouldn't want to single out black people particularly, but what do you think?
How are you going to disarm them if they are the police? You know, if they are the state troopers, you know, how are you going to disarm them? And, you know, we have to look at the rate at which black people, Latino, indigenous people get killed without any recourse, you know, and get killed basically with impunity already by the police and other forces who are designated to use, quote unquote, violence or force in this country. So if you're not serious about disarming them, you're not really having a conversation that protects anybody.
As I recall, back in the late 60s, when Reagan was governor of California, he embraced gun control when the Black Panthers started carrying arms, right?
That's right. That's right.
So what does that say about, the history of gun control in the U.S.?
I mean, we can point in the same direction because many people in the liberal community, you know, folks point at the NRA. Well, the NRA was also in support of disarming black people in the 1960s as a result of the actions of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. So, I mean, let's look at it and interrogate it, you know, fairly deeply so that we understand the nature of race in this country and how it affects policy in this country. And again, it gets back to the question of, you know, who is to be protected, who is to be served, and why? You know, and until we seriously have a conversation about that, again, you're leaving certain communities vulnerable to all of the violence justified by the state, be it, you know, under the control of a liberal administration or the control of a conservative administration. You know, from our vantage point, under the Obama administration, you know, I was part of a report that tried to document in 2012 and 2013 how many black people were being killed through extrajudicial killings by the police, to really point out that there was a directed campaign, I would argue, that was being unleashed upon black people then, in part in response to Barack Obama. But that was under a liberal administration. He had a lot of authority to kind of curtail it, and he didn't. And because he didn't, in part, that's why the movement for Black Lives arose, I would argue, in 2014, right? You can kind of see some of that coming. But the same figures were there when George Bush was president. The same figures were there when, you know, roughly in the same proportion when Bill Clinton was president. So liberal or conservative only masked the problem. The problem is the deeper issue of the very structural nature of racism in a society. And that is what we're going to ultimately have to address. I think if we're going to get real about any conversation about gun control or virtually anything else in this society.
I'm speaking with Kelly Okuno, an organizer with Cooperation Jackson in Mississippi. Yeah, there's a famous definition of the state by the German sociologist Max Weber, where he says that the state has the monopoly over the legitimate uses of violence. Do we want to sign that all over to the state?
No. I mean, I can't. Given who I am, given my, you know, positionality in this society, no. I mean, I think we want to get and move towards the development of society where force is not the arbitrator of disputes, is not the end all to be all, but that is going to take a radical reorganization of society, first starting with the material basis of eliminating scarcity, eliminating certain types of need for the competition of resources, which is a major catalyst, a driver of violence. And so I think we are at a stage in human history where that actually can be, parts of this question can be legitimately addressed. I think we are at a stage in history where scarcity can be a thing of the past, but it's going to, again, require basically a revolution on a grand global scale to get us to that point where we're actually utilizing all of the technology that we have built and all of the systems of delivery that we have built, the public infrastructure that we've built over the past 200 or 300 years, to be able to deal with a democratization of production and a democratization of distribution to be able to meet everybody's basic needs. That is within our grasp, and I think that's what we're ultimately going to have to look at. But to leave violence in the hand of the United States government and them be the only arbitrator, that is just going to perpetuate what we've seen over the last 200 years for certain communities. And I, for one, am doing everything I can to make sure that that system does not stand.
Other rich countries, Western Europe, Japan, you know, they don't have millions of guns floating around. Private gun ownership is minimal in most cases, and they don't have anything like the level of gun violence that we do here. What's different about the U.S.?
You know, I think the most apt comparisons when people draw that up are Canada and Australia, because what you have to factor in is the nature of the settler colonial origins of those three projects, which makes them profoundly different than the projects that people would look at, the nation states projects, say, in Western Europe. And there, all of those projects were based upon having a monopoly on behalf of European settlers of violence and the means to violence, and primarily the forms of arms. And if you look at even a society like Canada or Australia, where the level of personal gun ownership has been reduced, the actual level of violence against the indigenous communities is still as high as it is in Canada and Australia as it is here. So it's not the question per se of them having access to weapons, because that clearly doesn't diminish violence against the original peoples, you know, against the indigenous people. So there's deeper questions that have to be looked at. And I would say if you make that comparison to the United States, even though there isn't the same level of violence by means of guns on behalf of private citizens, there's still a tremendous amount of violence based in the settler colonial roots of these societies against indigenous populations and populations deemed to be others or outside of the primary citizens and subjects of the state.
Another difference between, you know, Australia and Canada and the United States is the high level of imperial violence that is perpetrated by the U.S. You know, we've been at war constantly for decades. I can't remember the last time we were not at some kind of war. So does that figure to the equation at all?
Oh, it absolutely figures into the equation. You know, I saw a post that I think summed a lot of this up from a friend on Facebook a couple of days ago. I wish I could paraphrase it more aptly. But this came from a friend named Kyle, and he summed it up basically like, look, you know, you have a society wherein virtually in almost every country on the planet, the United States has some military installation there. Almost half the countries on the planet, the United States has had some form of military intervention in, be it, you know, from the military itself or from the CIA or some other entity of the United States government. And they consciously and deliberately use force and use violence as a means of maintaining their dominance over the planet and their dominance over the nations of the earth. And this gets glorified on a daily basis, you know, in our society, in pop culture. And so, you know, it creates this notion that certain forms of violence are good and deemed appropriate. And other forms, depending on who is the initiator, quote unquote, are deemed inappropriate. And what you come up with is just a clear hypocrisy that I think everybody in this society clearly knows. And that is, I think, a deep trigger that has to be really looked at in terms of how do we tell young people to not solve things, you know, by means of violence when we have a Hollywood industry which is making blockbuster movies either in the form of kind of fictitious superheroes or depictions of war in the Gulf or war in Afghanistan. And all of this is glorified and rationalized and upheld, particularly for young men, as an ideal of who and what they should be. You're creating just a number of contradictions that have blowback. And that is, I think, I would argue that this is one of those forms of blowback.
Now, what about more routine, you know, urban gun violence? It's certainly not what it was 20, 25 years ago, but, you know, people are getting killed in Detroit, in Chicago, in St. Louis all the time. And I think a lot of people who want to see gun control want to do something about reducing that level of, you know, just street daily violence. What about that?
Even in where I grew up in Los Angeles, you know, in the height of the crack wars, the chemical and biological warfare, as we called it at the time, even when guns were not in play, there was a tremendous amount of violence. And that goes back to my last point, because the violence was primarily centered around competition for resources on a basic level. You know, who controlled what corner, and the profits that came from, you know, the various types of economic transactions that were taking place there, and who had a monopoly on, you know, the goods and services being distributed. Even if you take the guns out of the equation, because of the nature of the economic system and the economic circumstances that we find ourselves in poor Black working class communities or poor Chicano working class communities, there's still going to be a nature of violence structured around the competition over petty resources. You're not going to eliminate that by just taking guns out of the equation. You're going to have to, if you want the violence to end, you're going to have to get at the root cause of the violence, which starts with the settler colonialism, which starts with, you know, the capitalist system, which starts with the racism and white supremacy that are the foundations of this society. And until we deal with that, you're going to have different forms of conflict, you're going to have different forms of competition, and you're going to have different forms of violence.
And finally, as sympathetic as I am with the desire not to hand over the monopoly on violence to the state, it's highly unlikely that private citizens, even banded together, can really fight the superior armaments of the state. They've got so many more guns and people and resources. Is it really practical to think that somehow you can resist state tyranny with private arms?
No, it's not. I mean, I don't think we should perpetuate that illusion. Some people who want to argue for, you know, forms of community self-defense, which I think are necessary, should know that, you know, no matter of weapons training, small firearms training or rifle training is going to be able to deal with the drones that the United States government can throw at folks. The deeper piece about community self-defense really is an organized people. And it's us being organized and having a clear vision that is our greatest form of defense. Weapons, I think, in many respects, you know, to get to the root of it, at least from my vision, that's a secondary thing. I think they can be a deterrent if used properly. But in terms of dealing with the overall edifice of the United States government and the amount of, you know, destruction that it can bring to bear on anyone at any time, there's a higher level political organization that is going to be needed by millions of people to be able to negate that. And you're not going to negate it by out shooting them. I think that would be a travesty in many respects to even consider. It has to be the out organizing them and to organize the different forces that right now are the instrument of that violence, particularly the U.S. military, organizing the forces within it to be able to neutralize the orders that might come down, you know, from more reactionary and conservative forces to not perpetuate violence against communities. It's these types of mass strategies and mass organizing, I think, we're ultimately going to have to consider and make real through some dynamic organizing, I think, to counter the violence of the United States government, which can be, I mean, look, it's to this point, it's the... The United States government has amassed the greatest destructive power humans have ever amassed on the planet. I, for one, hope that no society ever even tries to match what the United States government has amassed over the last 50 years, and that we, you know, through our organizing and moving to different means of social organization based upon collective needs, get to a state and a place where we can eliminate all these weapons of mass destruction, you know, as the old saying, you know, turn swords into plowshares, you know, and go with that type of orientation. Because we are on course, I would argue, Doug, right now. We are really on course, and not just because of Trump's leadership, but I think just the nature of the capitalist system overall is on course for a tremendous period of creative destruction, which means war. And we need to do everything we can to avert that. And that's going to take millions of people across the planet being organized in some lockstep to resist our government's marching to war. And I think that needs to take its first critical steps here in the United States. This is you know, the greatest perpetrator of violence and has the ability to execute that violence on a scale never before seen in history.
But until then, no gun control.
Till then, I would argue no gun control that limits the ability of citizens to protect themselves. And if we want to talk about gun control and limiting including that conversation, taking weapons out of the hand of the police, then I think you can have a rational conversation. Until that time, you're leaving people to be vulnerable to the violence of the state. And that, for many of us, is just extending the death sentence that already haunts us.
That was Kali Yakuno of Cooperation Jackson. You can find out more about the organization by listening to my earlier interviews with him and by reading the book he co-edited, Jackson Rising, The Struggle for Economic Democracy and Black Self-Determination in Jackson, Mississippi. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Guns of Brooklyn, a reworking of The Clash's Guns of Brixton from a 2008 mixtape by Santa Gold and DJ Diplo. Next, Turkey. Last week, the Turkish currency, the lira, went into freefall, the culmination of a long slide. The country's president, Recep Erdogan, was once the moderate Islamist hope of the West, but as his popular support has ebbed, he's grown more authoritarian. Popular discontent boiled over with a 2013 Gezi Park protest named after a square in Istanbul. Erdogan crushed them, and his hand has gotten heavier since. He turned on his former allies, led by the cleric Fethullah Gulen, now living in exile in Pennsylvania, and accuses them of mounting the unsuccessful coup in 2016. There were reports that Trump's former national security advisor Michael Flynn was conspiring to kidnap Gulen and turn him over to the Turkish authorities. Last month, Erdogan called for snap elections in June, more than a year ahead of schedule, hoping the opposition won't be able to mobilize in time. Though if Erdogan's people are counting the ballots, the opposition will have a very steep hill to climb. If the 2017 referendum on Erdogan's constitutional changes, designed to give him more power, and which passed by a 51-49 margin, are any precedent, then those June elections won't be models of democracy. Meanwhile, the country's economic fundamentals have been deteriorating. Here's the Istanbul-based economist Sabri Onçu with more. Sabri Onçu. The Turkish lira had a bit of a rough go last week. It's recovered since. What sparked that crisis?
It has been going on for quite some time. But what happened, say, about 5-6 days ago was the interview Erdogan gave in his visit to London to lure some investors to come back to Turkey. And he said a few things about the role the interest rates play in the economy, and that inflation is caused by interest rates, and he would intervene in the affairs of the Turkish Central Bank and all that. And after that interview was published in the internet, when the investing community lost their trust in the monetary management in Turkey, they started dumping Turkish assets as well as Turkish liras. And that's what happened.
The lira had been sliding for quite some time beforehand. So this just reached a climax, right, last week?
That's precisely what it was. I mean, it was a free fall for a few days.
And now it's recovered.
Because Erdogan appears to have stepped back a bit. He now says that the independence of the central bank will continue. While he was in the past, until recently, trying to make it difficult for the central bank to raise the interest rates, now, because he stepped back, the central bank man was able to raise the interest rates about initially 300 basis points. And then they also made an additional, disguised, if you like, 100 basis points raised to the interest rates that calmed the markets.
What's been responsible for the longer-term slide over the last few years?
The structural problems of the economy, heavy reliance on external funding, the reversal of the direction of capital flows, the large current account deficit because of the structural problems in the economy. Energy needs to be imported from outside. In the Turkish production, intermediate goods and a big chunk of raw materials have to be imported from outside. And for that, you need money. If you cannot earn that money with your imports and other services that you sell to the outside world, as a result, you have to fund that current account deficit. And the current account deficit is quite heavy. Probably largest current account deficit among the OECD countries. In addition, the AKP economic strategy, growth strategy, is starting from the beginning, relied heavily on credit-fueled consumption as well as external borrowing of the Turkish corporations. So the private debt ballooned. At one point, all these debts become unpayable, especially if your foreign creditors decide not to fund you anymore.
Foreign capital had been in love with Erdogan for a while, right? But now they've changed their mind on him?
Foreign capital has been in love with emerging markets, peripheral countries, if you like, since the early 2000s, as you know, not only Erdogan. When Erdogan came, he promised to follow the neoliberal agenda that was imposed by the IMF after the 2001 crisis that took place in Turkey. He was talking about democracy and free markets and an intention to brew the process of Turkey's joining the EU, not only the foreign capital, but also Western powers, as well as domestic capital. Everybody supported him. Everybody was in love with Erdogan. He was even, as you may remember from publications like New York Times or Wall Street, The Economist, advertised as the Islamic Democrat, similar to the Christian Democrats in the West.
Then something happened. What? And they changed their mind?
Things started to change after the 2010 referendum that took place in Turkey. That referendum was supported by not only the EU, the US, Western powers, what have you, but also Turkish intellectuals, liberal intellectuals. And with their support, they hold a constitutional referendum, also named in Turkey by the opponents as Yes, But Not Enough referendum, because those liberal intellectuals were supporting the referendum under this slogan. They wanted these constitutional changes, but they didn't take those were enough for democratization of Turkey and so on and so forth. But the end result of that referendum was that Erdogan consolidated power and started showing his real face, his Islamist face. By then, at the time of that Yes, But Not Enough referendum, he moved from being Islamic Democrat to Democrat in the true sense. But after that, Islamism started to show its face, although it has been had been showing its face more or less even in the earlier period up until 2000. But it became more evident They also passed a law in the same year, which went unnoticed. And this religious affairs office or the presidency started to play a bigger role. And they won the 2011 election almost with a 50% vote. Never happened before. But once he consolidated all that power, he started deviating from his earlier promises. And as you may remember, in 2011, there was Wisconsin, Occupy, Wall Street, and then Arab Spring and all that, and that moved on. And eventually in Turkey in 2013, almost simultaneously with the Brazilian protests, a movement called the Gezi Movement, named after a park in Taksim Square, the major square in Istanbul, started, and the Erdogan started heavily crashing the movement, arresting and even killing a few of the demonstrators. About five or six people died. And he suddenly moved from, after this Gezi protest in 2013, moved from being Democrat to authoritarian. And objections started to came from its foreign supporters. So that's what made the major impact on his perception outside Turkey, I would say.
What is his power base, popular or elite?
I must mention that Erdogan's party, Justice and Development Party, prior to this Gezi protests in 2013, was essentially a coalition of Erdogan and his sect and a congregation called Fethullah Gülen Congregation. The Fethullah Gülen Congregation consisted of the elite side of the AKP. They were better educated. There were world-renowned intellectuals among them. While among the Erdogan's sect, the intellectual level is quite questionable. They are not as well educated as the Gülen congregation, or Gülenists, if you like. However, after a sequence of events, Erdogan started to purge those Gülenists. Indeed, there aren't many left that have any connection with the party, although they're still alive, and some escaped. So the Erdogan now is working with a less educated group of people, although he kept a few Gülenists, despite that he knows that they are Gülenists. They are not very powerful. In other words, they don't know the world affairs as well as the Gülenists did. But that coalition broke, a fight started between the two, and even many Gülenists are arrested and all that. So his only power base is based on his electorate and a few others who had been on his side from the beginning.
What kind of people vote for him? What support him?
Believe it or not, majority of those who are supporting him are from those classes that shouldn't support him for economic reasons, because through the economic policies that he is implementing, I mean, he's making their lives miserable every day. Life is getting more expensive, the incomes are not increasing and all that. Low-income people who still have some rural connections, who migrated to cities from rural Turkey over the years, not recently, of course, that has been taking a process that has been going on for quite some time, for many decades. It's that kind of people, small shop owners. And of course, throughout their rule, they also created their own capitalist class by allowing them to, or giving them guaranteed contracts and public-private partnership projects and other procurements and things like that, even if when they were tendered. So they are supporting him. The construction sector firms are supporting him. A small minority of rich guys who were made rich by the AKP are supporting him. But what's worse is that those who are against him are not doing anything. They can openly say what they think about what's going on. You never know when you may end up in prison without any explanation. and how long you are going to stay there, again, without any explanation and no court case and all that. I mean, things are not that pleasant in Turkey.
How severe is the repression?
If you are on the streets, you wouldn't notice anything serious other than heavy presence of the police in the malls, I don't know, underground, and some of the major squares and things like that. For the last few months, for example, for no particular reason, while walking on some central part of Istanbul, I was stopped at least two times by the police and asked to show my ID and all that. I mean, but for the ordinary people, especially if you are not objecting to the Erdogan's government, life is pretty decent. I mean, they don't touch you. They touch those who oppose them.
I'm speaking with the Istanbul-based economist Sabri Onçu. And so is there any kind of serious opposition to Erdogan, or does he pretty much have his way?
No, actually, 2010 was the peak, probably, of his consolidation of power, which continued, plateaued, if you like, until this 2013. And since 2013, he has been his power has been disintegrating.
If he's putting people in jail, how is his power disintegrating?
Support is going down further. The opposition is getting more vocal, and despite deep disagreements, now in the coming elections, all the parties that are except the AKP and one ultra-nationalist party, which is now the junior partner of Erdogan's JDP, they are all united in their opposition, although ideologically they are not united in any particular way. They all have their own worldviews and ideologies, but nevertheless, they are fighting heavily. I mean, if a, in quotes, normal election, where you just leave everything to chance, you don't intervene, Erdogan has no chance to win even the presidency. But he's not going to allow that, in my opinion. He also lost the support of the Western powers. He is trying to maneuver by sometimes trying to work with China and Russia and sometimes switching back to the US and the EU and all that. His power is disintegrating. And it's because of that he is increasing the repression.
And then Trump, I recall there was some scandal around the election that that people, was it Flynn, I think, was working to extradite Gulen to Turkey. Has anything happened with that? Or what's the relationship with Trump like?
You mean they were asking the U.S. to send Gulen back?
Right.
And working with some Americans, if I'm not wrong, Giuliani was among them, wasn't
yeah.
he? And there was some American general whose name I don't remember. Indeed, there was some rumors that he was prepared to actually hijack him.
Yeah, they were going to kidnap him, right? It was that Michael Flynn, that guy who didn't last very long.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
National security advisor.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You don't hear that anymore.
Yeah, so, but Erdogan and Trump have, I mean, they seem temperamentally similar in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. I mean, another similar fellow is the Indian guy, Modi. I don't think these days Trump and Erdogan are getting along that way. Their relationship changes almost daily, if I don't exaggerate. Sometimes they get along well, sometimes they don't. In the past, Erdogan used to claim we were strategic partners. He went to England a week ago or so. There he claimed that now we are strategic partners with the UK. Sometimes we become strategic partners with Russia, other times Iran, some other times China, again, sometimes U.S. So things are in that front, at that front, quite sporadic. They change.
Getting back to the economic problem, the central bank, by jacking up interest rates, was able to stop the currency's slide. But what is the longer-term strategy of this? Turkey is still very reliant on foreign finance, right, and
of course, and
imports. So what's the longer-term strategy to balance the books?
For the time being, there is none. I mean, the objective at the moment for the current government, which is under Erdogan, although he's the president, and we are not yet in the presidential system. It's still the parliamentarian system. And this coming snap election will change that if he wins. So there is no strategy. They're trying to save the day until Erdogan manages to win this election. If he can, we'll see. And I don't think he has any intention to let go of his power. He will fight tooth and nail, in my opinion, and there will be blood, is what I expect. As it happened, as you may remember, in the 2015 election, there were two elections in 2015. In the first one, they lost the election, and suddenly bombs started exploding. ISIS appeared. Hundreds of people were killed with bombs. Attacks were made on the Kurdish towns. And the second election was called in November. And after that, Erdogan won the majority again in the parliament. That is JDP, not Erdogan, because he was already the president. But it took lots of blood. If he loses this, you never know what may happen. They are the state now. They can do whatever they want with the ballot boxes. The opposition is trying to monitor the ballot boxes, control the ballot boxes so that no votes are stolen and all that. But, well, they have, according to some newspaper article, about 500,000 soldiers and policemen involved in these elections monitoring the ballot boxes, and those are under their orders.
And so there's no strategy for righting the economy and balance.
Not for the moment. They keep telling that we are loyal to our original promises. We are still a market economy. We will continue with the structural reforms, which has never happened actually for the last 20, 30 years or so. We have been structurally reforming Turkey for that long. Probably since this neoliberal agenda started in early 1980s. So they keep telling that we will do the structural reforms and all that, suggested by the IMF. And so they're trying to, what's the right word for that, convince their earlier supporters that they did not deviate from their original promises, and that this is a market economy, you will do whatever you do. But you observed what happened in Malaysia recently, right? The ex-PM, because of all the bribes that he took from the public-private partnership projects, is being interrogated, probably jailed or something like that. So the corruption there, I don't think, is no different than the corruption in Turkey. So I don't know. How are they going to solve this corruption problem to convince the Western supporters that this is a functional capitalist free market economy? Difficult to know.
And is capital flowing in or out?
For the time being, it's flowing out.
It's flowing out.
Both from the domestic treasury bonds as well as domestic shares.
And is there any foreign investment coming in at all?
Of course, under these uncertainties, even the leaves don't move. The economy is not doing that great. The population is heavily indebted. Incomes have not raised. People cannot spend. I mean, as the Keynesians say, we are suffering a serious lack of aggregate demand problem. Production doesn't take place. Foreign investors, direct or portfolio, are not very, what's the right word? I don't think that they have the trust in Turkey, that at least for this period, until the end result of the coming snap elections are known. So that's the situation.
And so if the central bank is raising interest rates and the population is very heavily indebted, that seems like a formula for a financial crisis and a serious crack-up.
Of course. I mean, if you don't raise the interest rates, then the lira will tank. If you raise the interest rates, then the economy will tank, and again, the lira will tank. I mean, this is a dead end. From here, the only solution, or if it's a solution, of course, I see is going to the IMF and asking some help, as Argentina did a few weeks ago. That's what's going to happen. IMF will come back.
That's not going to solve any long-term problems, though.
Of course. I mean, it's going to worsen the problems. But that's what's going to happen.
That sounds
because the IMF will ask austerity.
Yeah, so it's just going to be more of the same.
It's even worse.
Yeah. The upside of a credit boom is fun, but the downside is not.
Yes, of course. I mean, you are quite happy while you can easily borrow and spend. But when the time comes to pay the debts back, if you don't have enough income, and most of the time if you borrow that heavily, you'll never have enough income to pay the debts back, a crash occurs. And a deep slump of many years, as it happened in Greece, for example. Remember, since 2012 or so, Greece has been almost in every year in economic contraction, which is essentially a long-lasting depression. That's what I expect to happen in Turkey also.
How is the Istanbul-based economist Sabri Anchu? That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the scherzo from the String Quartet No. 11 by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by the Sorrel Quartet. Till next week, bye.